Cinnabuds receives support from Associated Bank.
Cinnabuds, Cinnabuds, two buddies talking about cinema.
From Milwaukee Film, I'm Christopher Pollard.
From Radio Milwaukee, I'm Dori Zori.
And today we're going to be talking about the new George Clooney film, The Boys in the Boat.
You're announcing the team today. Are you going to make it?
We rode out of need.
Come on, boys.
The need to stay in school. The need to eat, to sleep.
We got
to
keep these, right? As long as we stay on the team.
Washington Huskies coach is bringing an inexperienced boat to competition.
They said we couldn't compete with the richest schools in the nation.
The Washington boat has taken the lead. Washington has done it.
I got 9 seconds under the course record.
The Boys in the Boat is a new film from, like I said, George Clooney, and it is about one of those wonderful underdog stories of American sports. The University of Washington men's rowing team, who stunned the world by winning gold in the 1936 Berlin Olympics.
And Christopher, we're not just talking about the movie ourselves. We have two very special guests joining us at the podcast today. Introduce yourselves.
Hello, I'm Jenna Rose Murdaugh. I'm one of the daughters of Joe Rantz.
And I'm Matt Murdaugh. I am Joe Rantz's grandson, or one of his grandsons.
And if you haven't seen the film yet, Joe Rantz is the main character.
Yeah, he's
basically.
The guy. He's the guy in the film who plays a pinnacle rower on that team. And he is played by Callum Turner in the film, who is an incredible actor. Yeah. So we're going to be talking to them today about the relationship to their father or grandfather, as the case may be, and about the film, which we both just saw this weekend for the first time. It was very exciting. We'll be right back. Stick around.
Hey, Wisconsin foodies. This is Tariq Moody of Radio Milwaukee. Join Milwaukee Magazine's food writer Ann Christensen and myself every Friday morning at 8 a.m. for This Bites, Milwaukee's longest-running culinary podcast. We talk about everything from new restaurants, pop-ups, cookbooks, events, and even an occasional interview with a local chef. Head over to RadioMilwaukee.org/ThisBites or listen anywhere you get your podcasts.
All right, we are back, and we are talking about The Boys in the Boat, and we have Jenna Rose and Matt here with direct relations to the Joe Rantz from the film.
So what I want to know first, before we get into the actual film, is did you grow up with rowing and this story as like a larger-than-life story that was told within your family? What is your relationship to this movie before it actually came out?
Well, yeah, we all knew that the dad had won the gold medal, obviously, and told us, you know, rowers are humble. So dad was humble about it. You know, he didn't go around bragging. And for many years, the gold medal was lost up in the attic stolen out of the box that it was stored in with other stuff by a squirrel. And so it has little squirrel teeth marks. Where it carried it.
Wow.
So we didn't really even have it to look at. But, you know, it's in the history books, so you know. So we grew up knowing that. But like I say, rowers are humble, that it takes all eight of them doing exactly what they need to do to make it work. So in that way, he didn't brag about it, but it was just part of his life. If you asked him, he'd talk about it. You know,
that is really interesting because you do see that in the movie. They talk about eliminating yourself out of this. This is everyone working as one. And one of the greatest lines in it is, you were one of the seven. I think they say towards the end, you were one of the seven. He goes, no, I wasn't. I was part of the one. I'm paraphrasing
that was so
terribly.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing. You should see the movie for the actual quote.
I mean, one of the things is they'd even get together every 10 years. They do anniversary rowing.
Ooh. Oh, really?
So the teams would get together and they'd row like against the current varsity. And so they get, you know, every 10 years they'd win it up until eventually, you know, one or two started dying, died.
I think
one
it was
died
about
from cancer.
When they were in their 60s and they lost one rower and had to have like one of the coaches sit in.
What? And they were beating varsity teams at 50.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about this group of 7-8 athletes together that created such magic for so long?
I think that it was probably the growing up in the Depression, you had to be a certain kind of character to survive. And that's one of the miracles of this book, that you look at these nine boys, and Joe in particular, whose life was a mess with abandonment. He was, you know, the typical, like, nowhere man, and he had to only depend upon himself. So they learned how to depend upon themselves, all of them. You know, nobody had any money. They lost everything they had in the Depression. So they were all working hard labor jobs, whatever they could find, and they were strong mentally and physically. But also, everybody was that way. And so they had that need to succeed kind of attitude that I don't think rowers now have. I mean, they go in and they row. They may be rowing like Yale and Harvard did back then, where they row in high school and they learn the techniques. But these guys knew nothing when they started college. They didn't know anything about rowing.
And it seemed, too, from the movie, which I'm guessing was a compliment of what was really happening in life, like East Coast wealthy kids were the ones that rowed schools, and boys like this who didn't have money didn't have that experience. But is it true how he got into rowing? It was to be offered a job and offered a place to stay. That was how they got rowers into that university rowing team.
I mean, it's a little different in the movie where he was living at the time, but I mean, they did it to get a job so he could afford, and you know, they got the food along with it, because they would always get meals with that as working at some point. And it also provided a place for them to stay, too, along with that. And it was, you know, some of them, they didn't have that kind of stuff. And so that was one of the main reasons that they went into it.
Literally room and board.
Yeah.
And there was also, I don't know if it was a guarantee, but there was the possibility of getting summer jobs.
There was a
connection with the rowing and getting summer jobs. And the most memorable is the one where they would help build the Grand Coulee Dam.
Wow, really?
If you've seen pictures of the guys hanging over the edge, you know, doing the jackhammers on the side of the rock wall where they're building the dam, that was what these guys did. My dad and Shorty Hunt and I think Chuck Day.
Yeah, the three of them were.
Yeah, went and were doing that one summer.
That
earned enough
wild.
And, you know, so the summer jobs gave them the money for the next semester, the next year's classes.
And just to let everyone know, so if you haven't seen the film, this is essentially towards the beginning. There's no spoilers here. But it's a bunch of guys. They're drafted, essentially. There's tryouts. It wasn't, like you said, the kids who learn it in school and go on to expensive, you know, universities and are learning it. They're just drafted in because they're strong. They're strong. They went through trials. They could see some talent in them. But they're coming into it kind of fresh. And then they were all molded into exactly the part they needed to be in. And some of it did, like you said, many of them did it through just need at that time.
Yeah.
The thing you really comes across when you watch this movie is that it is that classic underdog story. And you hear that, and you hear that in film, like people talk about all the time, and it gets to be a bit like, oh, it's an underdog story. But the thing is, regardless of whether you think this is a real story, this actually happened.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
this actually happened. This isn't Bad News Bears. Yep. This is a real people who did it, and you can't help but feel that when you're watching it.
Yeah.
And it really, really comes across. What do you know of Joe Rantz from growing up? What was your relationship with him?
He was a wonderful dad. He's the kind who would encourage whatever you wanted to do. Instead of saying, you know, rowing is great, you ought to go into rowing. We also were musical, for instance. And so some of us had experiences being musical. My older brother was one of my brothers was into drum and bugle corps.
Yeah.
And in, of course, the school bands and as a drummer. And so we followed all around the state with him with competitions during the summer. And my sister had a horse. Well, actually, my oldest brother had a horse that and then to get a better paper route, bigger paper route.
Oh, really?
And then after a month, he realized, well, the horse costs money to feed and take care of, and that was out of it. So my sister inherited it. So she took up horses at age 14, and lifelong, she still has horses. And so we went all around. She joined 4-H, and she was competing in things. And we went all around the state and around the area and that kind of thing. He supported in whatever it was that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And if he didn't know about it, I remember I've been told that he'd go and learn. He'd go home and learn it.
Learn about it.
Was about
it. Yeah.
So they could then figure it out.
Very
like,
curious
yes.
person.
Yes. And so he didn't, there wasn't any really negative things. I mean, he never got angry. He always talked things out. He always problem solved. He taught us to look at things a different way, out of the box kind of things, because that's how we survived.
Another thing Grandpa would do from what I've heard is he also taught at, you know, he'd teach all different subjects at like the community college. He'd do like, you know, mushrooms, teach about mushroom grazing, you know, foraging. He'd do... you know, powder puff auto mechanics, you know,
square dancing,
you know, any of those kind of things. Cause he also did band, he played banjo and he did square dancing during college and things. It's not really in the movie, but they go and, you know, Saturday night during the shows at the theater, the movies, him and a couple other guys would be the band during the, you know, beforehand.
Oh,
kind of
really?
Thing. They'd have like a little band playing beforehand. I guess that was common in those days.
What a cool guy.
Yeah,
what
he
cool
had
guy.
A lot of interest, which makes sense. I mean, again, seeing in the movie, and again, I'm only judging for the movie, not being a relative. But going from like, working so hard to make sure you're going to school for engineering in the film, that was accurate too. And then working just to the edge of your energy to learn rowing, this very precise sport at the same time. I mean, that does read, because you're saying like he would go in, he would just learn whatever he needed to just to support your interests and stuff.
And if anybody in the community had an interest that they wanted to learn more about, he'd volunteer to teach him, because he would go and he'd learn about it and he'd research it and then teach it to the community. In the community
I'm
school.
Exhausted just listening to a couple of things.
When did he sleep?
Yeah. Where does the sleep come in? That's really impressive.
Well, you know, they don't cover too much of this in the movie, but it started from, you know, a young age with him. He'd, you know, when he was younger, he went at one point to Ruby Mine when he was around 10, and his dad moved up there with their new parents. And during that time, he started a garden, you know, to grow extra food for the family. And then at some point, I mean, to go into all the details, but he was kicked out of the house by his dad's new stepmom.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
And he moved
because
in with the school
house. Because
his
younger brother was picking the weeds like he was, but behind him, but it wasn't weeds, it was the carrots.
Oh.
So he went and was on his own there and would help out in the kitchen a little bit to get some food. And then, you know, later he went out to Squim out on the Olympic Peninsula, and that's where he was living for a while with the family, was all out there. And then Grandpa and the kids, or my grandpa, his dad and the kids left him there again at about 15. So he kind of had to learn how to live on his own. Now he had the house, but it was just the shell of a house.
Yeah.
So he, you know, went and split wood, figured out fishing. They stole moonshine from the drop points of the local moonshine dropper and filled it with cheaper, like dandelion type wine.
But only did every third bottle.
Yes.
So that they couldn't prove anything.
That it could have just been a bad batch that those other people got, and they'd sell the good stuff at.
Yeah. That's very smart.
So there could
that's
be a
my
prequel.
Favorite detail.
It wasn't for them to
third.
Drink. It was for them to sell
right.
the good stuff.
Wow. They knew how to do it without getting caught is my favorite part.
Yep. I have a question for you guys. So there is a book that preceded this movie. Yep. What do you remember about the book? Who wrote it? When did you become aware that there was a book being written?
So the author, my mom's sister, Judy, lives, she's out in Seattle, out in the west or east side Redmond area. Mm-hmm. And their neighbor, like down the street a couple of houses down, is James Brown, who's the author, and he wrote another book under the Flaming Sky, which takes place up in northern Wisconsin when we had the Peshtigo fire and stuff.
Yeah.
Now that's actually covering though a story of that over in Minnesota is what that story's about, a fire, that part of that whole storm that came through. And they were reading that to my dad when my grandpa when he was staying at
my sister's house.
Yeah. My Aunt Judy's house. He was later in life, and was in lower health and was staying there. And they were reading the book, and Judy was like, "You want to meet the author? He's only down the street." So they brought him over one day. And part of this was, go ahead.
The reason that he wanted to meet him was because there was a name of the newspaper person who ran the newspaper called Angus Hay. And my dad goes, "I know Angus Hay. He was one of the three men in our three-man band." Oh. Angus Hay. And Judy goes, "It can't be, because this guy would have been in his 70s and he wouldn't have been in high school with you." So that's where they were able to bring Dan Brown down to the house. And Judy had always thought she says, "I write short stories, but I'm not really capable of writing this story." So she thought, well, if the two of them got together, maybe Dad could see how Dan wrote, and Dan could hear Joe's story from the horse's mouth and see if he was interested. So I don't know where you were with that.
Well, no, that's about right. So then once they talked about it, the author, James Brown, actually asked Grandpa at some point during the conversation, Judy first said, "You should ask Joe about the boat."
Yeah.
And so then, Grandpa went through and explained some of that, the story. And then James said, "Well, I'd like to write your story, Joe." And Grandpa said, "Well, no, I want, if you're going to write it, it can't be about me. It has to be about the boat."
There you go.
Oh, well, yeah.
And that's where it comes from. Exactly. It has to be about the boat, because it's not just him. It's the whole group of them.
It's the group as a whole, as one.
By the way, the
Angus Hay, after the fire, Angus Hay Sr. moved out to, of all places, Squim, Washington.
Oh, really?
And settled. And so this was Angus Hay Jr. that was the age of my dad and played in the three-man band.
Oh, really?
So that was a small world.
So yeah. I don't know whether that's a cosmic connection. Yeah. Cosmic? I don't know.
So that is wild. Matt, was your grandpa still around when the book became a number one bestseller?
No, he died 2007, so it was kind of starting of writing of it, but it wasn't at all finished. After he died and stuff, he had done some interviews with James Brown, and Grandpa had done some interviews, but a lot of the book actual writing was done by James Brown, with my Aunt Judy was kind of like the researcher or kind of the information gatherer. It's not really even researcher. She was more contacting the other people.
And Dan would contact her also for how things are said. Does this ring true to how Joe would say it, or how the family, would say things or do things? So he was trying to make it authentic to the real situation. So they collaborated on it.
And then one last question. So when they were getting ready to make this movie, do they reach out to the family? Was there any connection between the making of the film, or is it mostly between the author and the movie?
Well, it was mostly from the book that had been written that started.
Yeah.
George Clooney read the book way back when and loved it, so said it's right away. It's got to be a movie.
And how did that make you feel when someone of his stature, George Clooney, recognizes that it's a great story?
It's nice validation. I'll tell you.
Was that a phone
call? One thing, if I can tell you, my dad, have you read the book about the boy?
Yeah. I always thought, cool, because it has to at least go somewhere. With somebody of George Clooney's level, it's not just going to be some small, director that, it'll come out, but, it might not even make it to theaters. With somebody George Clooney level, it's going to at least make it into the movie theater.
Someone
will
hear
that.
You know
how it's going to do, but you at least know it's going to make it that far.
Right.
Originally, when the book was not even written totally yet, and they sent out to people, to the publishers and stuff, the initial 1.5 chapters, so that you got a, and the synopsis. And they got an offer that they took the offer for the book and a movie from the Weinstein's Corporation. And thank goodness that that fell apart.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
I don't know that they would have had the same feel for the movie.
For sure,
and so
yeah.
By the time that they had to wait for the 7 years for that to be gone, that promise.
Right.
Because they had to do it within 7 years.
Oh, exactly.
The
yeah.
movie.
And they didn't.
So after that, then George Clooney was able to pick it up.
Became available again.
Yeah, became available. Yeah.
So lucky. That's so really wonderful. Yeah.
And then, I'm just also trying to put myself in your shoes, being able to go to a movie theater and watch this film about my dad or my grandpa. Was it a big family affair? Did you all get together and try to watch it together? Because it sounds like your family's spread out over the country.
Well, so we've got... My dad, because my mom moved here when she was, after college, she came here for a job, and then she met my dad, and she stayed here. So her side of the family's all out there. Here we found there was an early screening they were doing a week before, because it came out on Christmas Eve officially, even though we found it actually came out even the day before Christmas Eve. But we found a showing the weekend beforehand, and a couple of the theaters, one of them was the one out in Brookfield, Majestic. Mm-hmm. And we got, we sent around, got some people from church, we got some of our family members, we got some relatives in Madison and stuff, and friends and stuff. So the theater was pretty full. It wasn't a huge theater in there, but it was pretty full from what we had. So we had everyone come and we watched it then, and that was the first time we saw it. And we've seen it. I think I've seen it one more time than mom, but it's been about 6 or 7 times we saw it in the theater.
Oh, that's great.
Every time we do it, we go out and
she's holding up
we're
7
being told
fingers.
7 for sure.
And we'd go out and we'd mention beforehand, either it was her or me or on our own. We'd say we're Joe Rance's, relative, whichever one we were. And we'd say, if you want to talk to us afterwards, we could, talk right outside the theater. And we get people we didn't know that were there, that say,
just
come over.
Enamored with the idea. And that was our point of that doing that was, it wasn't for me, it was for them, to give them, the people in the audience, a personal connection to the movie, because it was such a special story, a real story. And they could identify with that underdog business. So giving them a little bit extra important, we thought.
Yeah, that's great.
What a bonus if you were a random person in that theater that
and
day.
That showing that we went to,
So you gave us a lot of really wonderful background stories about Joe Rance that kind of, I'm sure he sounds like such a fascinating person that we could fill up 3 podcasts with this. But what would you like the listeners to go away with, whether they've seen this movie or they're about to see it? What would you like them to think about when they see Joe on screen?
Well, you've kind of covered it already, some parts, but people say, well, that doesn't seem realistic to me. There are some things in the cinematic that they've changed,
Kind of like too good to be true.
Right.
Yeah. They did cut it down. By the time they got to Olympics, that was their third year, right?
Yeah.
It was their third year of rowing. They cut it all down into a 1 year rowing because you can't show multiple years of rowing in one movie.
Every single meet,
you just have to be showing the rowings and that's it.
Even just 3 Poughkeepsies, winning, it's the same row, same place.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's not all true. It's a good movie. It's heartwarming and it's nice to, it gives you an example of what life was back in the 30s that you don't always see too much of just, regular people's life anymore.
And it was a tough life. It was a time period when we need to remember.
For sure.
Yeah.
No, I think they did a good job when watching that movie. You really get a sense of that time and place.
Yeah.
I also was very anxious the whole time they were watching Berlin, Germany at that time during the Olympics. How that must have even been. Hitler wasn't there watching you row. Maybe he was. I don't know. But
He was.
He was on the final race. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
They have pictures of him in their film. Showing him, looking at the race.
Mm-hmm.
The
But oh, during the credits when they show all the photos of the actual
oh, the real
no,
photos
no,
at
but
the
I
end?
Mean the real films that that was it Global
oh like documentaries
yeah they
Lenny
actually
Reifenberg.
Have real
oh
she did
yeah
the film.
Yeah yeah
she's got pictures of the race and of Hitler sitting in his box watching the race
oh my gosh.
So that was part of the movie. They actually have real footage of like the actual, some of the major races that they were in. At least the ones at the Olympics, they've got videos of all those races.
Yeah.
So they were able to actually kind of act out those actual results and stuff pretty accurately.
Oh, wow. That's wild.
That is really cool.
I guess one other thing is the resilience of these characters.
Yeah.
You know, and... they just, they had to do so much more than the average person nowadays does to succeed. Like I say, they didn't have that background of doing this from the time their kids playing on the football team and then getting up there and playing in high school and college and getting paid for it and, you know, professionally. Yeah. This was just grassroots people that, that were trying to survive.
Yeah.
And the resilience of them is phenomenal. I think
The beautiful thing too, like the coaches that they had need a lot of credit too for recognizing the talent and putting this team together and then taking the chance to uplift this team over maybe a more senior team that might have been at this school.
Yeah, so. And you could see in the movie the coach Ulbrichtson that worked a couple times with my dad when he got the clue that this is really someone who's worth putting the energy in trying to help him, you know, get past the ability to not trust anybody but himself.
Jenna Rose and Matt, we really appreciate you coming in. This has been fascinating, especially so fresh, because like I said, we just watched it and then we immediately get to meet you and hear more about the person we just watched.
Do you want to know what the most common question is when we came out of the theater?
For sure.
The first question is, what happened to Joyce and Joe?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Did they get married? You know, because it leaves them as with this lovely kiss, but you don't know. Yes. I said, I'm here. They were married for 65 years.
Oh, that
you know
was
what?
Your mom.
And I'll tell you what, the only reason I didn't ask that question is because that was also my first question, but I looked it up immediately after watching it. So in my head, I'm like, no, I already know that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would come out of the theater asking that one.
That is great.
And I think that probably is it contributes to that whole business that that she was kind of a pivot point of, for one, his family, someone he could trust in.
Yeah.
From Squim, they developed a relationship. And it was something that in the end, the fact that he could let go and he could give her this big kiss was saying, it's working.
Yeah.
You know, I've got it. Life looks hopeful now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a super romantic moment.
It was.
I'm glad it turned into 65 years of marriage and the fact that we get to sit with the two of you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much again for being
thank
here.
Thank you
this
so
has
much.
Been really great. You stick around for 1 second. We want to have a couple other people to thank really quick.
Yeah, we would like to thank Kim Shine, our producer of Cinebuds.
Absolutely. We want to thank Newski, who does the wonderful theme song for our show every week.
Thank you so much to Associated Bank, one of the sponsors of our podcast.
Absolutely. And we could not do this and would not want to do this without our members, both from Radio Milwaukee and from Milwaukee Film.
Indeed.
And we want to thank you two for being here once again. We really appreciate
Jenna
it.
Rose
welcome.
And Matt, thank you so
Thanks
much.
For having us.
Boys in the Boat is available online right now, so go out and check it out. It's a great movie.